Simcar 17. Horace, we want to briefly survey the ongoing attacks on the auto stack, everything from the information layer, obviously the Ubers and Lyfts, and trying to improve utilization of the fleet to reduced interest in driving, powertrain attacks, hybrids and electrics, channel attacks on the current dealer model. Obviously, the process, you've talked about Gordon Murray, and we've talked about low-speed cars. And, of course, the jobs to be done, the internet shopping and all the things people do. And then I read the other day that e-bike sales, electric bike sales, are up quite a bit in Europe. So there's a lot going on. So let's talk about what pops up on the stack.
E-bike is funny. The mail here in where I live is delivered by a mailman or woman that rides a bike that has an electric motor to assist, you know, not just they can pedal by themselves, but it's assisted.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I noticed it had the Samsung logo on it, the on the battery pack. So I don't know if they where they are involved in that value chain, but yeah, there's a lot of things happening. So what I wanted to do was step back a minute because we've been looking at this universe by sort of like a, you know, trying to visualize an elephant by touching parts of it, and. And I think the problem is that it's not an industry that will change based on one vector of change, meaning that we're going to see a powertrain change or fuel change, we're going to see business model innovation, or we're going to see in injection of software. I think that you know, you can go back and think about the telecom industry, which is enormous, over the period that it's been transformed from analog circuit switched to digital packet switched, and the subsequent rise of the smartphone. It's still an ongoing transformation. That process began arguably in the 70s with digital switches, with dialing that was, you know, not rotary but tone dialing. So a lot of these innovations have been placed, you know, building up over time, and many decades later we're seeing some of the impact in the way we communicate. Where we've moved beyond voice, we've moved into messaging as a genre of communication in and of itself. So the thinking is, maybe the right way to think about it is not there isn't a singular Big Bang event, like let's say Tesla, that everybody gets behind and says that's going to change the auto industry, or even the fact that we may have breakthroughs in batteries. But rather that there's a lot of little things happening which may culminate in one in a transformative a transformation of the industry dramatically. And notice, by the way, when you look at the telecom industry, although there've been turnovers in terms of companies that are at the device level that have gone in and out of that business, so they've been disrupted in a way. Still, we have mobile operators, which are descendants of fixed operators.
Sure,
many
the copper
of them,
era. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And those themselves are descendants of the so-called postal and telegraph network people in many countries, which were state-owned for a long time. So that doesn't – we haven't seen the disruption at the network level. We haven't seen – a wholesale replacement of the incumbents with a set of entrants. And that's because it's a complex, multifaceted market. There are infrastructure, regulatory, and there are
tax regime. There's so many players with their hands in the pot, definitely.
Yeah. And so there's definitely, you can look at the providers of devices, which used to be called terminals of the network, that
you're showing market, your age, Horace.
Well, you know, even a few years ago, people were still referring to them as terminals in Nokia. That was Nokia's. I think Nokia network people still think of the device business as the terminals. So that's the dumb device.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not even the computer terminal that we think of because a computer terminal is the VT100 or whatever, mm-hmm. but the telecom terminal is literally the phone that sits at the edge of the network.
Right.
So that's why I think when you think about the auto industry, we're not going to see, I think, a big bang. So the question then is, where would these attacks on the stack happen? You know, the Uber, which is going on the service layer, driverless cars, which is going at actually the notion of who is a driver, who is a passenger, the job to be done.
Job to be done, exactly.
Right? Yeah. Then you have injections of software in the entertainment segment, which therefore might mean that people will make decisions on cars on the basis of other than the badge on the front of the hood.
You know, I have to mention that because I read a review. I don't know which car. Anyway, maybe it was an Audi. But they were talking about how they have 4G LTE built in, and clearly this shows you the power of the operators to provide the right incentives to the manufacturers to get their stuff on the devices. It's just amazing. You
know? Just to tell you another story, another anecdote, I just bought a car. I'm not going to mention yet what it is. We'll have to discuss that on another show.
Yes.
But it's a car that's actually 2006 vintage, and it comes with a SIM tray. No Bluetooth, no auxiliary audio input, no.
It must have a line in, though, I assume, probably.
No, it doesn't.
None of that, yeah.
No. You got to use FM.
Focus on the driving horse. Come on.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, you got the SIM tray, and like, there's no way to actually connect your phone to it. And that's 2006. That's not, that's 1 year
before the iPhone. 8 years ago, yeah.
So. Anyway, and that's still a fully functional, serviceable car by any means, by any definition. So anyway, the point is that might all change, but we see the limits of that because the lifespan of the vehicle is such duration, and the replacement cycle therefore is long. The pipeline for production is long, and so on. And production, now going down the stack a little bit, so you got production changes going on where potentially we'll be in the more modular production world where rather than sheet metal stamping, we go to composites plus tubular frame, which is the iStream process.
Sure, and i3 has some of that. BMW's i3 has some of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you might see alternatives to it, and that may catch on with more and more. Mm-hmm. And the main benefit of that is, frankly, it's that you can scale down in terms of production. So you can make production runs at much lower volumes economically. So you don't have to do 200,000 units to break even. You can do 20,000 units on the plant. And that could really enable entrants to come in with, let's say, a vehicle more for, let's say, very narrow niches like urban-only vehicles, vehicles for... by the way, there are vehicles that are built today custom for track use. This is more in England than anywhere else, I think. The UK, we have track-only vehicles, which are, still road legal, but they're really pretty useless in a day-to-day environment. But they're designed as essentially as cars you play with. They're literally toys. And yet that's a market that requires low volume. And if you look at the designs of these products, they're essentially tubular frame with bolted on body panels.
Sure, there's a big off-road market in the U.S. as well, similar.
Yeah, you have these
niches.
Mm-hmm. Niches growing, and then the options now exist to do much more of that, and potentially that will create the opportunity for contract manufacturing in automotive, because again, that's been something missing. We mentioned, I think, before that it's extraordinary when you go from the computer world to the car world that there's no real value chain modularization going on where a company could say, well, I'll source not just interior parts, but also the engine from one company or another, where I'm going to, you know, outsource manufacturing to another company, and I could switch, you know, one year to the next from who supplies me with manufacturing. So there's a lot of that possibility now that's emerging because of new processes and new composite materials. Then you keep going down the stack. Then you go into the fuels and the drivetrains. Drivetrains, evolution there, dramatic. And then we spoke about this earlier again, that we touched on a lot of these things. One issue with electric is that it's actually a lot less wear and tear, a lot fewer moving parts, yeah, a lot less heat. 75% of the energy, by the way, this is an interesting data point, 75% of the energy that enters the vehicle in the form of potential chemical energy in stored in the fuel, only about 25% gets converted into motion. 75% of that is usually wasted heat. And so really for every ounce of energy, or that's the wrong measure, obviously, joule of energy, you get motion, you know, you get 2 joules of energy that are discarded. So there's that element of opportunity, right? Where you know, if you didn't have the heat, mm-hmm, you wouldn't have to deal with as much the longevity of, you know. But then that may, may work against the whole system. By the way, one thing we haven't talked, I think, much about is insurance. Just that whole segment of the economy. Because insurance may have to change dramatically if you don't have a driver, if you don't have a car that breaks down as much, or that it has a lot more, it's easier to repair because it's modular and so on and so on. So who knows what the implications might be, right?
Yeah, I think your comment about jobs to be done is, to me, a great place to look. I just think about our kids when they were in high school, and how it's different from my era some decades ago. You know, today you text one another, message one another, and say, hey, I'm going here, going there, can you give me a ride, or let's go together. So just the ease of sharing, the ease of information sharing, you know, that maybe that takes away 10 trips from a pool of cars in a month. But if you take that across a population, all of a sudden your demand for cars is smaller, or it's stretched out more. You don't need to replace it as often and all that.
Yeah, and I want to touch also on the job to be done. This is an important thing. When I think about, like, you know, a multi-generational phenomenon, like things changing across generations, is, you know, I mean, trying to get to the bottom of one of these paradoxes of these nostalgia vehicles. So you have cars nowadays that are built, yes, strictly for middle-aged men that
you and aren't I, so Horace, much, yeah.
Yeah, but not so much that they have a crisis, but rather that they're trying to relive their youth. So you have muscle cars, you've got badges on, you know, even mini cars like Fiat 500 and Mini so in other words, it's not nostalgia only on the muscle, but rather on that car, sure, that, in your youth that actually
period of time, the 60s, 70s, sure. Of
course. Yeah, you know, you had that moment when you fell in love with the thing, and the thing I struck me, why would you fall in love with a car in the 1960s, right? And my tentative conclusion is that what cars represented then were not just a nice object. Obviously, it embodied somewhat the aspiration of the generation of sort of sex appeal and of course,
it was a dating vehicle, a travel vehicle. I mean, it was freedom.
But it was more. It's, you know, I think it's even deeper. I think what cars enabled a lot of people during the 50s and 60s to have is freedom, right. And this is very, very important, and this is why a lot of detractors of the vehicle, they don't address this point. They say cars are evil and our cars are polluting and cars. Yes, they are those things. But that's a price that a lot of people are willing to pay. Not for transportation. No, no. It's for freedom. And what did that mean? If you go back to 40s, 50s, 60s even, the populations were fleeing from urban centers. And that's true even in Europe. That's true because there were all kinds of inner city problems everywhere. In the U.S., Obviously, I don't have to get into it, but there were, you know, when the car came about, people could live in a utopia of their own choosing, which was that you wanted to have your own house detached sufficiently from your neighbors with something of grass that gave you some sort of feeling of pastoral, bliss. Whatever the reason, right? People felt that that allowed them to live in a better way, and it allowed them to not be constrained in what a city defined their living environment to be. Now, many people now actually aspire to live in the city because they think of those things that we associate with suburbia as hassles, as you know, that it's feeling has
changed. It's too much of a tax. Yeah, they want to be closer.
Right. There's a lot of suburbia. I feel that, right? I feel very much there's benefits in the urban environment. But what I'm saying is that you have to put yourself in the mind of someone 40 years ago. And that was a mind that felt the car was actually liberating. And that's why it was such a hit. That's why the Volkswagen Beetle, people bought them by the millions and tens of millions in Europe, in America, the Mini, the Fiat 500, the Citroën 2CV. Every nation seemed to have its people's car. And that, why would Europeans want a people's car? Because they felt they needed to escape from the constraints that they felt there were upon them. Now they want to escape away from the car. Fine, but the point is this, that the job to be done of freedom is simply at the bottom of the nostalgia, about at the bottom of the romance of the car. There's always this cliche about Americans having a car culture and sort of being completely in love with the car. I think Germans have it in a whole different dimension, as we talked about before. But there's always this underlying, even deeper job that I think both of these are symptoms of, which is that the car is liberating. And personal transportation, so you don't have to share with others, is actually very liberating. So you don't have to live close to others is very liberating. And that's why romance is associated with it, power and sex appeal and all these other things. Now, again, that can change. It will inevitably change. And that need for freedom didn't exist prior to the 1940s, for a lot of people either, because they were actually migrating to cities, migrating from the countryside because they wanted to have employment.
Sure, the jobs were there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things change, right? I mean, this is, I talk sometimes there's this notion that people are define something as desirable and universally agree on that, but yet a few years later you realize that there's actually, maybe that wasn't desirable at all. There's this notion, for example, people say we need jobs, we need to have more jobs, and lots of jobs is good and no jobs is bad. Well, my point is that, if you take that basic assumption that jobs are good, well, you ask, when did jobs begin? Jobs are a product of the Industrial Revolution. People didn't have jobs before industry made jobs. And so the problem is the end state that, the utopia that you're dreaming of everybody having a job, is that was actually in the 19th century, that was actually hell on earth, is to have a job. You were right. You're forced off the land, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to work 9 to 5, punch a clock,
than 9 to 5. Oh yeah,
but worse, your child labor, you had right. pollution, you had mm-hmm. terrible working conditions away from your family, migrant labor, all kinds of abuses, hazards, fires, all these things, and people said this was hell. This was absolutely the worst thing for humanity. Communism arose out of that as a reaction to these perceived injustices. And now we all say, well, we all need jobs. I there's a point in time in which we're going to say maybe everybody having a job for life isn't the ideal state of humanity. And we've built on top of jobs all these other things. We've built on top of jobs taxation and education and And the roads we build, speaking of cars, is sure. That, you know, to get people to the office and get housing, them back home.
Everything. No, it's based. I think it's I think the jobs to be done is a great place to start. The other piece of data that I saw recently that sort of tells me where we are, and I think your analogy to the operators, the cell operators, is interesting. Because they're tightly wrapped up with the tax regime, the regulatory world, and obviously have a lot of political influence all over the place. But the guy that runs Honda in the U.S. this week said that he was very concerned about some manufacturers expanding their subprime financing and, priming the pump. So to me, these are indicators of a system that's as we've talked before, Rome is burning to some extent, and they're just doing everything they can to perpetuate the current model, whether it's the dealer channel or the financial thing. And I think that we're probably in the last days, maybe the last decade or two of that. And the Ubers, who knows who will be the winner? But the financialization happening so fast after 2008 is fascinating to me. But there you are.
Yeah, the question always in my mind is what is going to change and what isn't going to change. It's not, you cannot say, it's naive to say everything's going to change, because in fact, as big a proponent as I am of disruption theory, there are things which don't change. And this is where you have to ask. This is where the taste and judgment comes into play. Is that you have to have an instinct, even without data, to know when what will and won't change. So, for example, one thing that I think focuses the mind a lot is energy, because of the way there's a lot of impact from
geopolitics,
carbon.
Everything, of course.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So let's reframe the discussion for a moment around energy, because I'd love to dig into some data. The energy. Picture is very difficult to get your head around because of where do you begin? You know, you talk about how much oil is burned or where does it come from? Is
right.
it low?
Do you believe do you believe the data? There's always that.
Yeah, there's always estimates involved. But so I've been looking at a particular type of data set from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which actually simply illustrates or visualizes and aggregates data from the Department of Energy. And this data set, we're going to send folks, the link, and I wish we could make this a visual medium, because I could actually point at things that are hard to describe visually or verbally. The diagram is called Estimated U.S. Energy Use. That sounds great. And it's by year, so I'm looking at 2013 now. And what it shows is using a diagram type called the Sankey diagram, which is connecting boxes with lines, but the width of the line is representative of how much flows between boxes. It's usually used in process analysis typically in like thermodynamics when you look at a chemical reaction or chemical plant, and you look at the things going into it and things coming out of it and things looping back sometimes, and it's very common, therefore, with energy, because you're with the lines you're quantifying the energy between sources and consumption, and in this case it's actually. On one level, it's pretty simple. You have all the sources available of energy into the United States. You could do this globally, and there are global equivalents of this, by the way. But so just reading off the list here of what they list as all the inputs are solar. Great, everybody loves solar. Nuclear, not many people like nuclear. Hydro, the dams, which again we can pass judgment on that if we wish. Wind, geothermal, which is hot springs, right?
Sure.
Natural gas, methane mainly, coal, biomass, and petroleum. And that's it. There's, how many is that? 8 different inputs of different sources of energy that the United States is currently tracking, right? We could throw in food, but that's actually not part of this picture. Food is to some degree, biomass comes from, let's say, corn that is converted to fuel. But this is not about fueling people. It's about fueling the infrastructure.
Transport.
Right.
Infrastructure.
Well, it's not just transport. So let's talk now about the other end of this diagram, which is where things go. They go into residential homes, right? Commercial businesses and offices in general. Industrial, which is also businesses, but manufacturing. And finally, transportation. So these are the major energy services consumers, or the consumers of energy as a service. In the middle, there's an intermediate box that is fed energy and comes out with a different form of energy, and that's the electricity generation, right? Petroleum typically goes into transportation via a refinery, but that refining process is not shown here. It's part of the transportation box. Same with industrial. But electricity is shown as an intermediate step because things go into it and then the electrical power goes out of it into the other boxes. What this diagram then shows the connection between all these boxes, how much is going out of each of these boxes into all the endpoints. And another thing it actually represents is how much energy is actually not absorbed but thrown away. And they call that rejected energy. So in this overall diagram, let's sum up the inputs. The inputs are 97.4 quads. Now, quads means quadrillion BTUs. BTU, unfortunately, is a U.S.
British thermal
unit. English system.
The King system, yes. The
British thermal unit, I think it's the BTU. The equivalent would be joules, and wouldn't be quads. It would be called, I think, exajoules. I don't remember exactly how many, but quads is a quadrillion of BTUs. And 97.4 was the total for the United States for 2013. Of that, services, the actual productive use of that energy, is only 38.4. So about 40% is usable. 60% is rejected, is thrown away. That's 59 quads. And a lot of that is because these are inefficient, right? The when you think about residential, commercial, whatever, you know, you're heating the house. Some of it is thrown away because you're throwing the there's inefficiency inherent in the process of heating, transporting, converting, and all of that. For example, the electricity generation is 38.2 coming in. But of that, only 12.4 is actually used. The 25.8 is all because it goes up the smokestack or through the power lines on the way to the final destination. And so this is one of the issues with when you look at energy is to just realize that 60% is actually not consumed by or is not put to work directly and ends up in the atmosphere as typically as heat. Now, what the transportation sector, so that like if we focus away from all of these industrial or residential things, the transportation is shows as absorbing 27 quads, 27 out of 97. So about 25% of the energy that the United States takes in goes towards transportation. Again, though, 75% of that is thrown away, so only 5.6 is actual energy service. That is a shocking thing when I looked at this. You know, out of all the energy, we think that, yes, cars are a big part of the U.S. energy picture. And by the way, transportation includes buses, includes trucks, includes ships, airplanes, everything. Yeah. So, in fact, there's a breakout of this transportation box, the 27 in 5.6 usable. And they break it down by different forms of transport, different types of fuel, everything from diesel to, you know, the really low grade oil that's used on ships. And so you have there's an interesting the automotive sector of transportation is actually significant but not majority's share of the transportation sector. Don't quote me on that. I need to check again on that exact figure. But it's there are many boxes inside of transportation. But the thing that I thought of when I saw this diagram first time 4 or 5 years ago. What I thought is, hey, this is great. Now we can actually decide if we want to get rid of oil. What scale problem we have to deal with. So if you look at petroleum, by the way, and you follow the lines, you'll realize petroleum that's coming into the country is 35 quads. Transportation uses 25. So 10 of those are actually going to other things like industrial.
Sure.
Okay. Some of it goes to residential, like oil heat, very common in New England. Some of it commercial heat, obviously for buildings, and industrial use where that fuel is used for, you know, running machines.
Sure, or plastics or other things.
Or plastics, yeah. Exactly, as raw material. So you do have this, the transportation sector, though, is the biggest user. What the transportation sector, for example, however, does not take stuff from the other boxes that are incoming. There's no nuclear going into transportation. Some nuclear, I mean, it goes into electricity generation. Or all of the nuclear goes into electricity. And yes, there is a tiny, tiny amount of energy coming out of the electricity generation into transportation. And that amount is 0.0257. 0.0257 out of 27 is electrical power going into transportation. And actually, when you read the report, it says that's actually mostly these golf carts. It's not even showing up. The Teslas of the world are not yet showing up into this picture much. So that's how much more oil is you're depending on oil. There is, by the way, biomass, which goes into ethanol. There is a little bit of natural gas. There's probably some fleet vehicles powered by natural gas.
Right.
But that's 0.795. Mm-hmm. Even that is, you know, 0.8 versus 0.02. You know, natural gas is like an order of magnitude more than electrical right now. In biomass is 1.2. It's two orders of magnitude more than electrical. And that's about it. There's nothing else going into transportation today. There's no solar. Now, for solar to go into transportation means you'd have to bypass electrical generation and put a solar panel on the roof of your car. Then you could actually argue that you're using solar directly. If solar goes through something else, then you're actually essentially having it transported to your car via the existing grid. Mm-hmm. Right? There is one bypass of solar and goes straight to residential, and that's because there are homes with residential, there are homes with rooftop panels. So this is the diagram, and what you have to believe is this. Here's the way I try to analyze it. Is I said, well, if we want to get rid of oil, let's say a little bit more simply, let's want to get rid of oil that's used for transportation. Or even more simply, let's get rid of oil that's used for automobiles, because I think it's going to be really hard to get trucks and buses to switch to clean tech electrical right away. But if you were to whittle down, just the car part, and then say, okay, all we need, and by the way, since electric power is much more efficient, we're not going to waste 75% of the energy that goes in as heat. We're going to waste a little bit, but maybe, I don't know the ratio. It'd be nice to get that number of what is the from a joule of energy supplied into the car, how much of it is energy served into transportation, and how much of it is waste. But let's say, 80%, that would be great, maybe higher, hopefully. But that would mean that we should be delivering, and this is not yet done, but let's say it was four. We need four quads. Because don't forget, the only 5.6 are service out of 25. So now I'm saying, let's say the cars, the addressable market in that sense, is about, let's say, four. out of the total, and that includes inefficiencies. So then in order for you to make the auto market in the United States green, you'd have to substitute the about 4 quads worth of petroleum-based, actually, you know, throw with the stuff that you throw away on top of it, but you got to you've got to deliver serviceable energy of that magnitude from something that's green, which means solar, wind, hydro, perhaps, and maybe geothermal. And you look at the numbers that this graph shows, and you know, this is the quantity of those sources that's available. It's a challenge to figure out how to get those which currently feed into electricity generation to actually then feed into transportation. This is the fundamental problem. I think the fundamental problem is that you can't get there from here, in a way of saying, meaning that how do you get the solar, which let's say everybody loves, how do you get that into the car? You've got to go through electricity generation, but there are issues with, as you know, daylight not being the time when the car is being charged, and so you need storage. You have these interesting puzzles to solve. Let's put it this way. Now, I'm not against the whole question of can this be done. I think it can be done, but you have to understand the scope of the problem. And the scope of the problem isn't purely technological, that you need a breakthrough in batteries. It's much more about trying to make this system evolve. And when you looked at, and I have this data for the U.S., going back, they actually publish it on this site to the 1950s, but it's comparable. I have already scraped 10 years worth of data. and it's in my spreadsheet, and I'm ready to try to visualize it. But even with between 2003 and 2013, remember we started this discussion of what can and what cannot change. 2003 to 2013, you didn't see a great change in petroleum and coal and nuclear or natural gas. If actually there are substantive changes in natural gas. Natural gas has gone up a lot. Oil has not gone up unless there's a or gone down unless there's a recession. And you can actually see how the biggest effect on consumption isn't systemic change. It's more that there's a change in the demand.
Economic turbulence or something.
Yeah, there's demand. People are just usually on the industrial and commercial segment. They're just not consuming because they're not producing anymore. The GDP is going down. Energy use is going down. But as far as fundamental shifts, the biggest things you'll note are that, number one, gas has gone up a lot. Why? Because U.S. suddenly has a huge supply.
I'm sure the economics have changed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the prices of natural gas have come down. Availability has gone up, and that's due to mostly fracking. The other one that's grown a lot is wind. Wind has been huge, far faster growth, I think, than solar. The reason is, again, because it plugs neatly into the way the energy is.
It's distributed and consumed to some extent. I mean, you have to have the power lines, the grid accessible. And, of course, there's been a big tax subsidy for wind power in many states in the U.S. And Germany has had – the Europeans have also done a number of those things.
There?
Yes, hello? I'm here. Oh, yeah.
We were just faded strange for a while.
Yeah. Speaking of wind power, yeah.
so wind is interesting for many reasons, like you cited. So there's subsidies. There's a degree of consistency, I think, to the quality of the energy source in terms of consistency and reliability. Solar has probably a worse profile. If you were an energy, a power plant type of situation, you know, here this thing tends to be on or off unreliably, unless it's because, you know, it's in the desert, and the bigger solar plants are actually solar thermal, not solar photovoltaic, and the thermal ones are situated in Nevada, and they're massive, but they basically boil water, you know, or superheat some other material. Anyway, the point is that so wind has been very, very big growth, but it's still right now only 1.6 quads out of 97 is wind. Solar, on the other hand, is 0.08. That's all the solar that the U.S. is and of that, I'm sorry, not 0.08. 0.08 goes into electricity generation into that segment. There's a lot more residential, which is 0.23. So the total is actually 0.32, and wind is 1.6. So wind, both of them started with nothing a few, you know, like a decade or two ago, but wind has gone up a lot faster. And that's it. That was a surprise to me. We don't hear a lot about wind. But the others haven't changed much. Geothermal hasn't changed much. Nuclear kind of mostly downward trend. Hydro even also is on the downward trend. And so geothermal has gone nowhere. I think biomass has gone up, but I think may also go back down depending on a lot of other factors. So my problem is that when I try to understand the evolution of automotive technology for the purpose of, let's say, not just economic but political reasons, that you want to eliminate petroleum from your dependence, then I struggle somewhat with how do we connect the solar box, which is the most desirable, and maybe wind is actually the right answer. You know, we're fixated on solar, and if you look at why, because Elon Musk is saying that, right? Elon Musk says, I'm going to basically deliver clean energy, and the answer is solar. And coupled with the vehicle that is entirely battery powered. So this is the narrative. This is what people are debating, because that's in the spotlight, right? But it may be that actually wind might be the more desirable one, because it's actually better for the grid. The power
plugs in more readily, exactly.
Yeah. And also maybe it's available in more parts of the world that need energy. You know, if you look at Germany, northern Germany is filled with these wind generators, and a lot of northern Europe is actually very keen on that. But and by the way, this is also a capital intensive thing, and so is solar. But solar is more land intensive as well. You really need a lot of land, and which is why Solar City is saying, let's just use people's rooftops,
right. And let's lease them out. Environmental issues that are cropping up with covering up all the deserts and things too. But anyway,
Well, yeah, there's going to be always some environmental impact. But the point is that's still there's this kind of dark horse in wind that it comes up from looking at the numbers, right, at the data. The other question is, can we get anything out of geothermal more than we have? Can we get something on stream like tidal power, which somehow has never taken off?
Right, lots of promise, but
right, it's a lot of promise, and that's the problem. We have these things about solar that sounds promising, but it's not effective. It's efficient, but not effective. So this dichotomy I'm trying to verbalize is that you have people pounding the table on solar and battery power, but because of the efficiency, because, you know, you look at the numbers and you say, you know, that is the most optimal way of getting energy, right? Because it's like the math looks good. But the thing is that in history, the stuff that looks good on paper isn't the stuff that actually gets deployed a lot. The stuff that gets deployed is what's effective, what's actually compatible with a lot of constraints that are real world constraints. And that's why in many ways when you look at alternative energy power for vehicles, there are still those who talk about hydrogen. Hydrogen would be, you know, how would that fit into this picture? Hydrogen would be something that isn't a source in itself, but is extracted from something else. Like typically the most efficient process today is from getting it from natural gas.
Natural gas, right.
From the methane conversion process is a little bit more, or a lot more, I don't know, but more efficient than getting it from water via hydrolysis. But you could use solar energy if you have a, if it's abundant to you know crack water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then use the hydrogen to bind it back with oxygen from the atmosphere and make your car move. But that end to end, that's a very inefficient process because you've got to compress it. You've got to first of all scrape it, then you got to compress it and store it, and then gets back into the you know gets the energy back by binding the hydrogen and oxygen into water, and that too it has a there's an efficiency issue there. But the thing is that maybe again this sounds really inefficient on paper relative to just getting the energy straight from the sun and putting it in a battery. But the thing is that again when you look at the system effect and you got to analyze it as a system, it may not be effective. It's efficient but not effective, whereas hydrogen is effective but not efficient. It works in scale, but it looks wasteful. Whereas the solar pure, you know, let's say ideal, is efficient, but it doesn't necessarily work within the constraints that are in place. And if you go back and look at energy again, petroleum is not the first source we had for fuel. The first source actually was wood, and after wood came coal, and after coal came oil. And it's not because of lack of raw material. People were aware that coal existed. People were aware that oil existed during the coal era as well, but they couldn't make it fit into the system that they had in place, which was that, you know, they had steam trains. The simplest solution is to just have an open wagon that you throw coal into and then shovel it into the
boiler.
The boiler. Even when oil was available, steam trains did not convert to oil easily. The ships had to do it. The ships did it for various reasons. But even if you go back and ask, why didn't ships use oil and use coal instead? It's good. They have coaling stations. Don't forget, to store coal, you just pile it up in the mountain.
Right. Infrastructure, yeah.
To store oil, you need oil tanks. Mm-hmm. You need to build buildings for that for them. And so if you want to transport it, you need to build special oil tankers, whereas opposed coal transports in an open hull ship. It's a collier, it's called. And these things can, you know, be sail powered or whatever. And so for 100 years, people were using the much less efficient solution of coal instead of heating their boilers, which would drive the steam engines with an oil. And oil, by the way, needed refining as well. You couldn't use it in its raw form, whereas coal you could use in its raw form. You could just carve it out of the ground.
Throw it in the boiler.
Exactly. It just comes right out of the ground and goes straight into the boiler. Oil, you've got to refine it, which means you have to build a refinery, which, by the way, is still a big concern for many countries who don't have refining capacity because of high capital intensive. It also consumes energy to be refined. Refining is actually boiling it, right? You got to boil oil to get right. The essence of it out.
Yeah, most people don't want that in their backyard generally.
Right. And so you're using energy to distill it into a more usable form. And so you have different grades of distillation, which yield different grades of fuels. And so you have this interesting conundrum is that if I was in the 19th century, I'd be like, you know, an engineer would be pounding the tables like, why are you fools not using oil? It's so much better than coal. And the person, by the way, who pounded the table on this matter was actually, I don't know if it was actually Churchill himself, but he was the head of admiralty in Great Britain. The Royal Navy decided to switch to oil for very, very strategic reasons, that they wanted faster ships, which could be, you know, fueled by oil, would make turbines more usable. Mm-hmm. But then they had a huge problem because they had their fleet had to have fueling stations, and the coal depots they had to be switched over as well. And many times the coal came from Yorkshire in northern England, and they didn't have an oil supply. So in order for the Royal Navy to preserve the empire, they had to do a huge amount of strategic, probably is why they actually got into the Middle East in the first
place.
Lots
of geopolitics, absolutely.
Then the geopolitics came into play, right? And a lot of people, I'm sure, were scratching their heads. And if you only stuck with coal, we wouldn't have had all these problems. You know, we could have like kept the things going with transportation, because there were no cars, by the way. And you know, when cars were invented, and this is another interesting story, if you remember, 1886, Carl Benz invents the internal combustion engine, and he builds a car. Where does he get fuel for it? I mean, there's no fuel. There's no Exxon. There's no fuel station. He actually went to the pharmacy. Mm-hmm. He went to the pharmacy to buy, probably in a small container, the gasoline, which was probably competing with paraffin and a bunch of other distilled fuels, some perhaps even methanol and ethanol that were on the shelf for various purposes. Sometimes you would be for lighting, you would put them into a lamp. Sometimes they would be used for medicinal purposes. They you know, they, a lot of the fuels were used for, you know, at the time, you know, remember the 19th century, they went and got whales for whale oil, to get light in the house. It wasn't a fuel for
illumination,
transportation. It was illumination. And then gas came into use also for illumination. So you had gas lighting as a turn on, you know, as a switch you could flip on the wall and then suddenly have light in the house before you had the light bulb. And so people were using lamps and candles and all these other things. And that fuel was around, but just not on the scale that we think. And that's where, looking at the world from that perspective, you say, just a minute now, if I was in the 19th century, I should have told you that you go in this direction. That would have been the optimal direction. But the society did not take the optimal route. Society took the route that was the one that was essentially the least resistance.
Right.
It didn't have, you would just need to go one step forward, not 10 steps ahead. You know, one step ahead, and that step each time took you in a certain direction that was not necessarily the best direction. That's how real world works. And so, I mean, here we are sitting and debating what is going to happen for the energy that we use for transportation. And I'm just saying, I'm not certain it's going to be one or the other, but I would say that the discussion isn't purely on optimization basis. It's not what is best. That does not mean it wins.
No, the obvious is often impossible, as we know.
Windows, yeah. In speaking of technology, I mean, Windows 1, it was not the best operating system. Mm-hmm. All the computer scientists in the world, if you line them up in 1980 and ask them what is the best operating system in the world, they would have said Unix.
Of course.
You know, and, right, and they would have said,
yes.
Yes, and Unix was written by people who knew, who invented operating systems,
right.
Theory in itself. And so the winner, and you know, digital equipment, when they made VMS, it was not the, you know, ideal. It was a hack, and it was VMS that actually became the core, or the team that built VMS ended up getting hired by Microsoft, and they built NT.
NT, exactly.
And that was nothing to do with optimal. And it was very frustrating if you're an engineer at that time to see Microsoft win, when the workstations of the day, which were properly architected as microcomputers, lost.
Sure, HP Unix, Solaris, all these things.
Solaris, yeah. HP UX, the AIX from IBM. Yeah. You had all kinds of things. Long story, but the thing is that when you look at major technology adoptions, the solution that wins, that becomes most dominant, isn't the one that is most elegant, mm-hmm. most efficient,
technically pure, right?
Pure, technically
right.
Correct,
right,
exactly.
Right.
It's a kludge. It's a hack. And the thing that the mystery for an engineer is why? Why is it possible that society could do stupid things? And the answer is that society doesn't work.
It's the human condition. Well, I think to, you know, to wrap this back into a SIM card, which energy is essential to the whole analysis. You think about how the interests that are around fuel these days, or petrol in the U.S. at least, there's a lot of discussion now about declining gas tax revenues in the U.S. and what that means for governments, for local, state, federal governments, for maintaining roads and then everything else they do with that money. So there are people talking about, I think Oregon floated a law to tax by the mile or the kilometer, you know, whatever. And so I think we'll see some regulatory change over time just to preserve the cash flow. And of course, that'll have unintended consequences. And maybe, as you say, one of these beneath contempt or suboptimal options will emerge, and that'll be big enough, and it'll change the world. But
taxes and government are big wild cards in this whole story. Wars and all kinds of other things mm-hmm. that cause people sort of panic. I mean, the earthquake in Japan that caused their, you know, that was, by the way, one of the reasons I believe Japan was so keen on hydrogen is because they wanted to use nuclear power to essentially trap that energy in hydrogen, or use hydrogen as a battery. I always like to use this metaphor. Hydrogen is not the fuel. It is the battery which stores the chemical reaction, the potential energy that would have come from first extraction and then rebinding the hydrogen to oxygen and back into water. So it starts out as water, it ends up as water, and in between, energy is added in its conversion, and energy is extracted when it's returned back to water. And in that process, the hydrogen exists only in as a sort of a carrier of energy. And this model is something that I think makes a lot of sense for if you have fairly cheap electrical generation. And nuclear had that potential. You could build a bunch of nuclear power plants and essentially power your cars that way. You would run them at high efficiency. You would run them at high utilization, meaning never switch off. You would hydrolyze water or even methane if you really were desperate, which is not carbon neutral, but still better than oil. But you would do that, and then suddenly Japan would be finally free of petroleum. But what happened is this external shock came into the system.
Black Swan.
And now the problem with Japan is that it doesn't have the solar potential or opportunity.
It's too far north.
Yeah. And so for now, I think politically, they can't really push on that strategy anymore. But it made sense. I think the bureaucrats would have loved it that they could have done this plan in the long term. Same in France, for example.
I'm sure the Germans are shutting down their reactors too. Yeah, it's so there's a lot shifting underneath
I think it's still an ongoing discussion we have to have.
Yes.
Now we've looked at the stack again. We've sort of dove a little bit deeper into the how to think about energy. We're going to share the link to the Lawrence Livermore Labs data. And over time, I hope to bring that into actually doing, you know, munging it myself into a presentation that I can help an audience think it through. But the main question is that can we study this as a system, not as a module, and study, let's say, battery technology or study only manufacturing technology or study regulation and say, well, if this nut is cracked, then the whole stack falls into place. No, it's not going to happen that way. There's a lot of nuts have to be cracked individually. But one framing tool is this energy diagram that helps you think through how you're going to get there from here. And that's where in one other thought I had is that maybe the world isn't that it's going to all go one way. We have petroleum as the dominant fuel for transportation, but maybe actually the answer is that we will fragment, like we talked about these niches. Maybe we'll just have, you know, the electrical market will be 20%, the hydrogen market will be 20%, petroleum will be 20%, natural gas, you know what I mean?
Right.
It could be much more balanced. So you won't get rid of petroleum, but you will reduce the dependence upon it. And then the jobs to be done will be hired will be, you know, you will hire different fuels for different jobs.
Exactly.
So the city cars will be electric. Mm-hmm. The fleet vehicles might be natural gas. Fuel cell or natural gas. And you'll have fueling stations that'll offer you on tap. Do you want to charge your car? Do you want to put into it methane? Do you want to put into it hydrogen, or do you want to get petroleum? The good thing about fueling stations is that they already exist.
Right, the network.
You just got to upgrade them to.
I think your analogy at the beginning of the show to the operators is exactly right, because they have, by and large, other than a number of mergers and things, they have prevailed. I mean, they certainly work hard politically and somewhat the market, but really politically to shape the game to their liking, and only.
And you can't really get rid of them.
Right.
And what they're doing is also they're improving their performance over time. They're giving you more bandwidth.
Right.
And at some point, you can only really get rid of something when they're completely
irrelevant,
and over-serving. And I don't think they are yet.
No.
In the same way that I don't think you could say that a fueling station and a fueling network is over-serving.
Exactly.
Right? Because it's an infrastructure.
So we'll have plenty more to talk about in the future, Horace. And thanks for the good look at the stack and a deep dive into energy. We'll look forward to 18 in a few weeks.
Thanks.